her case was still unsolved, and she had been so terribly beaten physically and emotionally traumatized by what happened to her. I explained to her that what I was looking for were behaviors by whoever had done that to her to see if there were similarities and or differences between behaviors at the crime scenes, the murder scenes in Baton Rouge. My time with him was very short. It was under 20 minutes. He didn't become physical. He didn't threaten me. He didn't try to hit me. But his behavior went from ignoring me to acting very engaging, very appropriate, charming, to being inappropriately flirtatious with me. He was an incredibly articulate man, so I got it at that point. It was very clear. Yes, that's exactly how he was able to get close to so many people. You would never look at him and say, that's the serial killer in Baton Rouge.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. With me today from London via Skype is...
Laura Richards, advocate, analyst, and author, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and CBS's Beyond Borders, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
Well, before we continue our series on the murders in the bayous, killings, violent, brutal murders around Baton Rouge, Louisiana, why don't we take a moment to talk about our listener interaction? We've had a lot of feedback from listeners, and let's hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, seems like they've been really enjoying this series. And we've had a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you about. This one is from Michelle, and she writes, "Hi, Real Crime Profile team. I was very interested in your discussion of the different definitions of a serial killer. I'd also love to hear your insights into what goes into determining that there is one killer at work or more than one, how many and what types of similarities are most significant, and how do you know which differences can be discounted, particularly when crimes may be separated by years?" That's a big question.
I think you need to break them down one at a time.
All right.
So let's start with the first one.
So she wants to know if there are different definitions of a serial killer. Are there?
Well, sure. I mean, it's something that's hotly debated, actually, in the circles, in criminal behavioral analysis circles. And there's some academic definitions, and there's some legal definitions, and there's some practical definitions. In the FBI, we use the federal definition for serial killer is three or more killings. And that's stated by Congress in a law, and that gives the FBI concurrent and primary jurisdiction on any of those cases. But in the behavioral analysis unit, we look at it more as a qualitative analysis rather than just a quantitative analysis. And therefore, we use the number two or more for it to be a serial killer because many times they're early in their career and they're still the same person, mm-hmm. or we just don't know about other ones that are in between. Right, Laura?
Those kind of near misses and, you know, are really important. Sometimes they're not reported as well.
And so how about in the UK? What is their definition there?
Well, of course, you know, we looked across the pond when I was running the Homicide Prevention Unit with Commander Andy Baker, who was FBI trained.
Yeah, he's the one who introduced me to you.
That's right, at New Scotland Yard. So he and someone, the Assistant Commissioner, Tariq Ghaffour, were both trained at the National Academy. So when we were talking about setting up the Homicide Prevention Unit there, the serial killer group very much took the lead from the FBI, albeit that because we were looking at quite a lot of cases where we saw these near misses, we said that it could be, you know, two offences and a near miss, that you may have a very near miss collision, for example, in the aviation world, and they would review those cases. And that's why in law enforcement in the UK at New Scotland Yard, we decided to include near misses in all our analysis and the serial killer group to make sure that we didn't miss those, you know, incomplete offences and the learning. And of course, those near misses could take you to the potential offender as well.
Right. Yeah, and that's really astute because we did the same thing with child abductions. What we were finding is that we would look in an area when we got a report of a child abduction, we would look in the area and find no other abductions. and sort of it's a dead end. But then we thought, well, what about attempted abductions? The reason why many of them are attempted is because somebody happened to be nearby. So there was typically a witness who could identify them. So then we started creating a database of attempted abductions around the country. And so if we saw a completed abduction, we looked in that in that area and the neighboring states to see about attempts, to see if they maybe moved or were in the same area. And that way we had solid leads of type of vehicle, type of person, description, and so forth, and methodologies. So that was a really that was a really big leap for us in terms of being able to resolve some pretty horrific crimes.
I'm also wondering if Michelle's question is also about the different definitions psychologically, a serial killer who's a clinical narcissist, but I mean, or different motivations, different psychoses that, well, that lead someone to do that?
Yeah, that is an entire podcast. We can't do that in one section, but we should do that one day and talk about the spectrum of behavior that is motivationally tied to serial killing, because there are as many different types of people there are, that's as many different types of motives and psychologies that can be behind serial killing.
Okay.
So the next question that she had?
She
wants to know our insights into what goes into determining whether there's one killer at work. And that would be, there's a number of different ways. One is by forensics, obviously. That's one really pretty easy way to do it, unless somebody's using a forensic countermeasure. Mm. But the other way that we do it is through signature. And signatures can be used to link cases over time or geographic distance. Signature is nothing more than MO and ritual together. MO is modus operandi, or method of operation, the actions necessary to commit a crime and to get away and prevent discovery. Whereas ritual is something that is typically need-driven behavior. It's something very intrinsic to the offender. It's something they want to do. They feel a need to do, they have a drive to do, and a desire to do, and it's not necessary to commit the crime, but nevertheless, it's typically repeated over and over in any kind of crime series.
Can you give an example of this?
Well, for example, if somebody decides at the end of a violent crime to bite the victim's left kneecap, and he does that in every case, that's a very obvious sign that the same person is doing it, or a copycat has picked it up. So that's the kind of detail that the police would hold back. And if they see it in multiple crimes, they'll be able to tell. So that's one way. Anything you want to add to that, Laura?
Well, just to say that, you know, the method, the MO can change as somebody learns, you know, and, you know, obviously serial offenders and serial killers, they learn their, it's a horrible thing to say, but their tradecraft, if you like. So they will adapt that. They will be positively reinforced or negatively reinforced. So, you know, for example, you may have someone who starts out following girls or women and they don't take a weapon with them. But when they go for the grab, and the fantasy and reality aren't the same thing. So in the fantasy, she's compliant, but in reality, she's not. So the next time the perpetrator goes out following and stalking a female, they may take a weapon with them. And, you know, we have these conversations all the time, you know, with law enforcement of, is it the same individual or not, when you've got sort of an incomplete attack? So you've got to look at all of those things. And as Jim said, the more the signature side is much more idiosyncratic to a perpetrator, you know, and there's only a certain amount of behaviors. It's finite. So they're the things that Jim and I and others really look to. And the thing, you know, that might be at the center of it is power and control, what's motivating the perpetrator. So it is quite a complicated thing. It's complicated and complex when you break it down and disaggregate behaviors. And things like language as well is a separate analysis. The geography is a separate analysis. There's lots of different aspects and variables that you would look at. And, you know, the behavior obviously for us is key, but there's geographic profiling, you know, the victimology, there's so many different components to it.
Right.
And that's why experiential learning is so important, because it's a sum of a lot of cases that you've worked, as well as a statistical backdrop that may well play a part. But in my view, it can play a part, but it's a backdrop. It's not going to give you all the nuance detail and the context and allow for changes that a perpetrator may change in a particular event, or someone else comes on the scene, or there's an interruption. So it's not quite a simple answer to it.
Right. And that leads us into our next question, which is how many and what types of similarities are most significant? And how do you know which differences can be discounted, particularly when crimes may be separated by years? Well, that is an incredibly complicated situation. And as Laura said, it's experiential learning on the part of the profilers and the people in the unit and the people who are behavioral analysts. It's by doing thousands and thousands of cases that you actually educate your subconscious. And your subconscious, you learn to rely on that to do all the mathematical calculations. And you learn to listen to your gut instinct, that educated gut instinct that's based on all your years and thousands of cases. So it's not something we can answer simply. And it's why computerized models don't actually work, because there's no way to actually get that institutional model yet into a computer that in a way that it can think and it can basically suss out things that are important, that stick out to us. We can't maybe put our finger on exactly what the reason why we discount a particular thing, but we can know through experience over and over and over again that certain details are not important. And when we see a rare, specific detail, even though it may not stand out to everybody else, it stands out to us because we know that tweaks it just a little bit and gives us a new avenue to go down. And I've seen it many times in my experience and my colleagues, I'm sure you have, Laura, where it was one little detail that really turned the tide and put you on to the real killer.
That nuance thing that other people would discount and not see as being relevant or important. And that's why it's so important, the questions you ask. You put a case in front of, Jim, the TARDIS of his brain, the warehouse that has, these thousands and thousands of cases within it, and it's crunching and processing all that progressive bootstrapping experiential learning and pulling out those details that other people just wouldn't even find significant. And that one small thing could turn a whole case on its head and change the whole direction and outcome of an event.
I was going to say, it's one thing to clarify that when you're talking about a gut feeling that's based, as you said, on thousands of cases in education, not the kind of gut feeling that our friend Mignini had when he had a gut feeling that somebody was guilty based on nothing.
Right. No, I mean, what we're talking about is listening to your subconscious. Your subconscious works 10 billion times faster than your conscious mind. When you load your brain with data points, millions and billions of data points through all the crime scenes and the cases that we've consulted on and investigated and reviewed, that all that data, it's very difficult to consciously churn through every little bit of it. But your subconscious mind, if it is educated by all that experience, can actually do that work for you. But I wouldn't suggest anybody does it without actually having the experience behind it, without the training, the education, and the actual experience behind it. It doesn't really work. However, I will say that many of our listeners and people who watched Criminal Minds and other shows, Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, they have picked up details of what's important, what is something that you look for, and what might be irrelevant. And I think that people have become sort of armchair profilers, and they can really understand now. I mean, after 12 years of Criminal Minds, I think they've picked up a lot while they're being entertained, a lot of information. And I do think that it has raised a level of awareness of people in the community and around the world.
Yeah. Don't park next to a white van. That's what I've learned in the 4 years that I've worked
on
this
any
show.
Any van without windows.
Oh my God, someday I will tell you when I was approached by somebody in a white van who had limbs in his car. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Wait, you need to tell us now. What do you mean? You can't.
No. We'll talk about that when we get to our next case.
But
one quick thing before we move on. So you use the term forensic countermeasure. Now, I know what this means because I work on Criminal Minds, but do you want to just explain what that is?
Yeah. Forensic countermeasure is something that is used by an offender to try to throw off an investigation or prevent discovery. In other words, a simple one would be washing the body after you kill somebody to make sure you haven't left any forensic material there. Another one might be placing evidence that appears to point to somebody else at or near the crime scene so that the police pick it up and think, oh, now we have the offender. And there have been offenders, and I'm not going to be teaching people how to do this.
Oh, okay.
But there have been offenders who have effectively used that to delay discovery or prevent discovery altogether.
Okay.
I also just want to weigh in on trusting your instinct, just on what you said, Lisa, because actually victims of crime, I always say to them, trust your instinct. It is one of the golden rules, because when something doesn't feel right, you know, it might look right, but if it doesn't feel right, actually, you know, we are animals and we pick up things instinctively, and you should always follow that rather than saying, well, I'm not going to cross the road because I don't want to offend the person behind me, or I'm not going to jump out of the train or, you know, the carriage or the tube, yeah, and I'm on my own and there's somebody who's making me feel uncomfortable. I would say absolutely follow that and make sure you do follow your instinct and get to a place of safety, because 9 times out of 10, when I've read a rape statement or when something terrible has happened, a victim has intuited it beforehand and they've denied it. They've allowed the rational process to overturn the instinctive process. So that is an important part. And the same, you know, I always say with officers as well and law enforcement, part of the dash is about asking a set of questions about what's happening, behavioral questions. So we understand through the victim's eyes, because they understand they're the mirror to the perpetrator. And there is a question there for in terms of a professional judgment to be made. And again, 9 times out of 10, when officers feel that, or police staff feel that something's not right, normally, again, it's a sum of their experiential learning, but it doesn't stop there. They have to keep asking more questions. And it's the same with any kind of behavioral profiling. You have to keep asking more questions. It doesn't necessarily give you the answer. But normally, you know, because we are animals and because we instinctively pick up things that are in the ether, we have to attend to those things, and we can't always rationalize it. But you've got to keep asking more and more questions to get to, well, why does it make me feel uncomfortable? What's happening? Well, with behavior, it's not just about when we're profiling or we're analyzing and linking cases. It's not just about what's present. It's also about what's absent as well. So there's lots of things that you're looking to, but I think trusting your instinct, if you're in a place where you feel uncomfortable, and absolutely follow that.
Yeah, and I think that's a good caveat. It's more important to trust your instinct when you feel uncomfortable, because the circumstances look good, but you feel uncomfortable, get out of that circumstance. But if the circumstances look bad and you feel comfortable despite that, I wouldn't listen to your instincts there. In other words, err on the side of being safe. Don't say, oh, that person looks nice, or that person, I feel a gut instinct, they're going to be fine, and then go into a dangerous situation. Yeah, don't ever leave with somebody you don't know. Don't ever leave, ever. Fight with your life if somebody tries to take you physically from the place you are to another location. You're fighting for your life, so fight with your life.
All right. Well, thank you, Michelle, for that question. Wow, it sparked a lot of really interesting discussion.
So we're going to get back into the discussion on murder in the bayous, the killings around Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
These killers are not 100% successful, so it's very logical to look for survivors. So it becomes important as investigators, through contacts with other police agencies, to say, tell us about any police reports in which somebody was sexually assaulted or hurt but survived the assault. So look for those kinds of cases where it was an incomplete homicide.
So we're talking about the murders in the bayou, the killings around Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And we've discussed in prior episodes the cases that have been positively linked with forensic evidence and DNA. And we're now going to launch into other cases that are suspected to be linked. And we'll talk about the behavioral links and why we believe that they should also be considered victims of the same offender.
And once again, we don't use the name of that offender on this podcast. He is a very infamous person. A lot of people already know his name, his face, and everything about him, but we refer to him as DL.
So, Laura, why don't you tell us about your research into these other cases?
So one of the cases that I found was Connie Lynn Warner. This was a victim from 1992, so we're actually going back in time. But to situate us, it's 1992, August in Zachary, and Zachary's an important neighborhood in this series. She disappeared, and she was 41 years of age. She was an attractive accountant who disappeared from her home in Oak Shadows, which is a subdivision of Zachary. And that's in Louisiana. And that was either on August the 23rd or August the 24th of 1992. Her body was discovered on Sorrell Street on September the 2nd, 1992, near the Capitol Lake, close to State Capitol Building. And unfortunately, forensically, everything was washed away by Hurricane Andrew, which had swept through Baton Rouge on August the 26th. But it was determined that she died from a skull fracture, which resulted from her being physically beaten. So she was an attractive white female, dark brown hair again, pronounced cheekbones, wide friendly smile. So again, very attractive. But I think her injuries in terms of what she suffered and this, you know, brutality and violence that she suffered, along with the victimology. But the fact that, again, we've got another hurricane, we've got another issue around the forensics, so it wasn't ever linked forensically.
And it's something that came up again with Katrina, right? I mean, that wiped out many of the police departments in the area, all the evidence storage. I know that the FBI had to scramble and remove all their files from the first and second floor of the building that they were located in. Because the waters came rushing in, and I think that a lot of the people that ended up dead during that time could have been the victims of intentional murders rather than just the horrific death and destruction that storm brought.
Exactly. So, and this is why we say, you know, how many more? You know, if you're not able to do forensic analysis, or you're not even looking for it because you're sadly awash with people who have died, and you don't know whether it's natural causes or whether it's something else that's fallen on their head. So sadly, this was, you know, in some way a gift to some of to the serial killers that were active in this particular area.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. The serial killers that were active in this area at this time, there was a number of them. Probably the largest number that we've ever recorded in any area at one time. And why is that? Why were they able to get away with it? Was it the storms? Was it the lack of attention by the police department? Was it the rural nature of the area? Was it a combination of all the above?
So I just wanted to mention that since we're mentioning Connie Warner, who vanished from Zachary, that earlier in an earlier podcast, we talked about the 1998 disappearance of Randy Maybrewer, and also from Zachary. And in both of those cases, DL was questioned by Lieutenant McDavid, who suspected him then for many reasons, his previous crimes that he had been, what do you call it, precursor crimes?
Yes, precursor crimes. And many times we'll see an escalation of those crimes that when they're younger, the offender wants to commit the bigger offenses, but doesn't yet have the experience and the ability, but he will do things that sort of lead up to it. And so that's peeping and trespassing and burglary, which will ultimately culminate in rape and homicide as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Lisa. I mean, he actually said, this Lieutenant David McDavid, that DL was spotted in the same neighborhood in Zachary, round about Randy's, the time that she went missing, but even years before that. And he actually said that he had received several calls about a peeping Tom before Randy's murder, and it turned out to be DL. And they then had sort of a chase up and down Highway 964 and chased him through the graveyard. And that he believed that DL was responsible, but however, the profile supplied by the FBI, and I've got to bring this up, Jim, you know, there was a profile, and we did talk about that in our last episode, but the profile indicated that it would probably be, and I'm saying probably be, because no one can say with any certainty, but it would probably be a white male. And it was only later on when this Lieutenant McDavid understood that there was a possibility it could be a black male that he was then swabbed after the Diane Alexander offence. So yeah, I think that was an interesting narrative, you know, in terms of knowing who they're looking for.
Right. It's one of the limitations of profiling, that it can't accurately predict 100% of the time the gender, the race, the age, but it can typically accurately predict a number of the behavioral facets of the person that's committing this crime. I think also in this case, one of the issues was that there was an eyewitness who stated that they saw a white male in a white pickup truck. And I think that became a self-fulfilling prophecy, just like it did in the DC sniper case, that any time then anybody was looking for somebody who committed a crime like this, they would look around for a white truck, a white guy in a white truck, and that became their focus. People put blinders on. But, you know, profiling is only as good as the practitioner and the person and the experience and the information they get. So if there wasn't enough detail, it's very easy to be off on details of that profile. But the most important thing is that a profile should be a living document. As cases come in, this should absolutely affect how the profile changes, because, you know, in the beginning, when they thought it was only white women who were attacked, it may have been a much more reasonable conclusion to believe that it was a white person doing this. But when he crossed racial lines, that should have been a real indicator, a very serious indicator that the race may have been different. And I think, I hope that was something that both the profilers and the police took into account in this investigation.
Well, I think one thing that may have added to the confusion, I don't know if you agree, that the eyewitness said white pickup truck, white male, and it looked like there was a female passenger who was dead in the passenger seat. Now, that was probably not DL, but it very well could have been another killer that we're going to be talking about. So maybe she inadvertently profiled this, the FBI profiler profiled different.
Right. And I think you brought that up earlier. Since there were so many, 4 or 5 known serial killers operating in this exact, in that same location, in that same area of Louisiana at the same time, that there was probably some crossover in terms of who they suspected were victims of the killer. They didn't know. There's no definitive difference between what they were doing. We could only speculate, and we could only use whatever forensics and behavior that we had to determine, to distinguish between them. And I think that maybe some of the victims and some of the eyewitness sightings and so forth got cross-contaminated. And so people relied on that. And that's one of the reasons why in profiling, we never want to know anything about any suspects, because of confirmation bias. Once you believe that somebody has eyewitness identified somebody, or that there's something linking a particular type of person, it's very difficult to go around that and determine, you know, objectively who actually is committing this crime. So it's just one of the things that we do. And in any of the cases that we try to analyze, Laura and I and all our professional colleagues will specifically not want any information about any suspects, because it's almost impossible to just disregard that completely.
And there's another key point that also, if there's forensics, you know, if you do the crime scene assessment and analysis, and the forensics are processed, then obviously any forensic evidence or linkage should outweigh any behavioral advice or profile that's created. But of course, we know in this case that the forensics were not processed in every case. And that, again, was a serious issue in terms of linking these crimes, but as well as in terms of finding the perpetrator in the quickest time possible. So all these things do weigh in, and that's one of the key things that's always stated, you know, in any behavioral analysis, that the forensic science must take precedence over any behavioral opinion. So the next victim, 1993, and this was looks to be a near miss in the same series. Michelle Chapman's with her boyfriend, and they're in a graveyard close to where Connie Warner was attacked inside her home in Zachary. She's a pretty young female, brown hair, brown eyes. She's in a car with her boyfriend, and they're actually kissing, they're making out. And she reported that DL was watching them in the graveyard, and he approached them and then attacked her using some kind of machete. She said that he was a well-dressed male, clean-shaven, and she described sort of a rage and an anger in his eyes. And he actually almost severed her foot in terms of the brutality of the attack. And fortunately, a police officer from Zachary appeared on the scene and interrupted the attack on them. And he dropped the machete, grabbed his keys, and then he started running. And unfortunately, the police officer didn't manage to catch up with this particular perpetrator. And said that it was very difficult to secure any of the evidence because it was raining. So I think this is quite an interesting case, because she then picks him out of the police lineup 6 years later. She picks out DL, but he wasn't prosecuted because the statute of limitations had run.
Laura, what year was this for Michelle?
It was in 1993.
So if the...
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
He could have been stopped, you know?
Yeah. And all these women would have still had their lives. We did an episode, I don't know if you remember, called Lucky in Criminal Minds. And it was about how a particular offender just kind of slipped through the cracks again and again and again. And it looks like this guy had exactly the same experience, that he was able to, just out of sheer dumb luck, get away with stuff and then not have it followed up on.
Yeah, no wonder he got so confident.
Yeah.
I mean, he's literally picked out of a lineup and nothing happens to him.
Yeah.
Well, he attacks her and the police officer is on the scene and he still isn't caught, you know, within that bungled attempt, but he almost severed her foot. You know, and why is it relevant again? Well, in 1997, you've got the Eugenie Bois-Fontaine offense. Disappeared in 1997, either from Stamford Avenue, which, of course, we've got links with other victims in Stamford Avenue, or from the LSU Lakes, where she sometimes used to like to take walks. And I believe it was a visiting professor who found her credit cards around the lakes or near the lakes on June the 14th, and her body was discovered on August the 7th. In the bayou near the Alligator Bayou Bar. And it seems that she had died from a skull fracture resulting from a beating, so a physical beating. And although she was never officially linked, many of the investigators at the time, and of course there's still debate about it now, feel that the location of her home and the victimology and what happened to her indicates that that she could well have been DL's first victim from Stamford Avenue.
Right. And Eugenie's case has come back to life recently because of a wonderful show called The Killing Fields, which I believe I recommended earlier, where the detectives in Iberville Parish have been reinvestigating her murder with the original detective who was on the scene at the time. So Eugenie lived on Stamford Avenue, the same street where Gina Green was murdered. And later, Charlotte Murray Pace had also lived on Stamford Avenue and then moved and was murdered right after she had moved. So it does seem like there is a connection there, although currently they ruled out DL as being the murderer because they weren't able to connect him with the DNA that was found on her undergarments.
Yeah, I'm responding to that. That is not something that should rule out. That should be, well, we haven't ruled him in yet, but the behavior is one way he can be ruled in.
Yeah.
So it's just the DNA, because of contamination, because of the fact that you can get tiny, minute samples that really have nothing related to the case. And also, because the DNA can be from other interactions with other people, it doesn't mean that those are the people that killed her. It doesn't mean that there are, just because there's multiple DNA samples there, that those are all involved in a crime. So it's just a bad way to rule out people. A good way to rule in, but a bad way to rule out people.
I think they had the police had been waiting to hopefully get a confession. I mean, even though he's already in prison from DL, for him to admit that he had been her murderer. And, you know, he just died of a heart attack recently. So, you know, they're never going to find out from him. But, you know, that investigation is now, you know, open again and active. And it's really fascinating to watch old Rhodey Sanchez and Aubrey, his partner, try to, you know, put the pieces together. But I kind of, in my uneducated opinion, I kind of think this was the work of DL. So,
I mean, it's certainly, it's a 20-year-old case. They didn't do all the forensics in the first place. So, of course, there could be contamination as well, you know, in terms of those samples. But there were three profiles found. And as you said, you know, DL's wasn't one of them. But of course, we know that he didn't ejaculate in every case. There could be lots of reasons. And he certainly can't be ruled out when you put the geography, the proximity, as we've discussed, and also the fact that he had visited the house and he regularly fished in the area where her body was found. And they were, you know, eyewitnesses and people who gave statements to that effect. So I don't think that he can be ruled out. And certainly on that basis and what happened to her, you know, she was 34 years of age. When you look at her picture, when you understand that she, you know, had a skull fracture and had been physically beaten, you know, all these things, the victimology, the geography, the MO, what happened to her, all for me, the fact she was a white woman, brown hair, highlighted hair, beautiful smile, high pronounced cheekbones, you know, this case again, and again, just thinking it was 1997. So, you know, it was some time before, well, it was before Randy, who was 1998. And we know that that wasn't his first offense. So behaviorally, it certainly, to me, does look very, very interesting. So that's Eugenie. And following on from her, in terms of the other cases that are suspected or are interesting from a behavioral point of view, there's Christine Moore, who on May 23rd, 2002, disappears while she's jogging, and her body's found later on. She's 23 years of age and was doing a master's at LSU. And she was jogging along the River Road in Baton Rouge, not far from the home of Charlotte Murray Pace, who was murdered a week later. And her body was discovered on June the 16th in a ravine that ran alongside the Ebenezer Baptist Church, just a few miles further down from the River Road. She also died from a skull fracture resulting from blunt force trauma. Difference in victimology, she's a black female, dark brown hair, beautiful eyes, beautiful smile, and pronounced cheekbones.
Yeah, so you see the connections and location and the school being tied in, and they're beautiful women, but the fact is that her race now should have alerted people to the fact that this guy could be non-white.
I wrote that profile that went into the newspaper, and I did not put a race into that profile. The reason I didn't is because we had African-American victims, we had Caucasian victims. We were reluctant to put any race in there because of the variation.
Mari Ann Fowler was missing from 2002, and her body has never been found. And she's quite an interesting, in terms of victimology, she's slightly older. She's 65 years of age. But actually, when you see her picture, you'll see that she really looks after herself very well, was very attractive, well-coiffed. She had basically been outside. I think she'd been Christmas shopping, and it was Christmas Eve in 2002 at about 5:30. She just disappears, and she's the victim who is wearing diamond earrings and is very well heeled. And the detectives at the time did rule out robbery as a motive because she had Christmas presents and various other things that weren't taken. But her body was never found. She bore a striking resemblance to the mother of Pam. She was on her way to visit her husband, who was in prison when she disappeared. And DL was suspected at the time. What was interesting is that surveillance cameras picked up a General Motors pickup truck speeding away from the scene of the abduction. And tire tracks were also found too. And an image of the potential suspect was found, but they didn't think it was a sufficient quality to be able to make out who it was. But it could, of course, be enhanced. And DL had a similar truck at that time. And his cell phone also hit off a cell tower just 14 miles from where she was taken about 20 minutes before her disappearance.
And, you have so much data out there. I mean, that could have linked him to all these crimes. And there's a certain point at which the weight of the evidence, no matter how weak one particular case was, they should have looked at all of them together and gone after him.
Yeah, the count is up to 6 women just in 2002.
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable. And there's a number of other victims that also, by circumstance, seem to be related. Right, Laura?
There are. I mean, some, you know, there's not a huge amount of information on, so it's difficult. Some of them, you know, slightly different geography. But of course, we know that DL did travel. He did take jobs that were cash jobs and he did move around. But certainly Eleanor Parker was missing from November the 10th, 1981. This was believed to be linked. She was 18 years old at the time. She had enrolled at LSU and was due to attend in the spring. So she wasn't there at the time, but she was white, brown hair, 5'5", again, attractive female. She had been visiting her parents and picked up some winter clothing from their house and was last seen driving in the direction of her apartment on Garderi Lane. On November the 18th, her Ford Maverick car was found parked along the road where she worked. And it was said at the time that there was no sign of foul play or any sign of a struggle. But the clothes were all neatly folded, her winter clothes she had picked up, suggesting that she had not actually been home. They were in the car. So, I mean, it's not known what her flatmates said, but she had certainly moved into an apartment in East Baton Rouge with 3 women just before she disappeared. And, you know, her body was never found. So, again, the geography is very interesting. This is 1981.
It's 1981, and you know, it would have been a very early crime in this series, but certainly could have been one of the very early ones. There are too many coincidences about this.
There are. And then some of the others, I mean, certainly there was a male that went missing from Baton Rouge, someone called Glenn Tankersley, on December the 5th, 2002. And of course, this is a male, so it sounds very different in terms of victimology. But then there's a relationship between him and DL. And DL would give him rides to and from places, and he just disappeared off the face of the earth. A body was never found. And at the time, DL was suspected. And I've got to say, you know, he's been doing so many things. You know, what if somebody did start to question him? And he seems to be able to disappear people without anyone asking any questions. So the fact that he knew DL and, you know, was proximate with him and was getting lifts from him and then he just disappears certainly would alert. And I think, you know, they should have been asking more questions about that timeline and sequence of events.
I agree. And even though the victimology is radically different, it's the connection that should be looked at. And I think that kind of leads us to the people who might have been his last victims, that when a DNA sample was taken from him, he had his wife pull their kids out of school and they moved to Atlanta, right? Have they ever been heard of since? I mean, where are they? Whatever happened to them? Are they his last victims? We know behaviorally he must have been victimizing them within the relationship. There must have been domestic violence and abuse going on there, because this guy, I mean, so prolific, such a prolific killer, such a prolific hater of women, that, and it's brought out in the rage that he shows in his crimes, that he must have victimized his family, right, Laura?
He absolutely did. And, you know, of course, we could have opined that just from the behavioral profile. But 1998, he married Jacqueline, had two children with her, and he was abusive to her. Serious and physical abuse as well, domestic violence. And she did report to the police. She was missing for some time, as you said. And actually, I did some further research around that because I thought that was very interesting that no one heard, you know, hide nor hair from them. But actually, the FBI did track them down eventually, Jackie and the children. They were, this is some time ago now, they were in Chicago at some point, but she was terrified of him by all accounts. You know, when people disappear themselves, they physically take themselves away from everyone that they know and their own, you know, network of support. You know, I could imagine that this was a very real and credible threat. And she wasn't necessarily turning a blind eye to other things he may well have been doing. She was getting respite when he was out the house, you know, and she was terrified for herself and the children. And the same with the girlfriend that he had. He had numerous other girlfriends, but Cassandra Green, who also had a child with him. And he was arrested for domestic violence and beating her and for breaching orders.
I mean, how many times does this...
How is he...
I'm saying...
What a slimeback. I mean, you know, there's just... I mean, it's outrageous. And you're right. And everybody should be incensed and upset by this. The fact is that he had been within the clutches of law enforcement so many times.
So many times.
Nobody put all this together. I mean, this is just...
Or just the laws were not there to keep him. I mean, Laura, isn't that what's part of it? Is that there was no way to...
I'm not so sure, because I think a lot of it does boil down to the fact that domestic violence and stalking is not seen as serious, not then and still not now. And if I put into the mix that there was another victim called Colette Dwyer or Walker, who in June 1999 was at her home address... And DL knocked on the door and muscled his way in to her apartment and was trying to convince her that the two should date, that he wanted to date her. And she didn't know him, but she managed to get him out of her apartment by appeasing him by giving her his number, her phone number, and suggests that she calls him. So she gets him out. And days later, a friend who lives nearby her said that the same man was seen lurking around outside her apartment. And Colette herself then sees him again peering through her window and loitering around her property. And she then calls the police. So this is in June 1999. He is arrested and he basically is charged with unlawful entry and stalking. And it's plea bargained out and he pleads not guilty and he receives probation. And the court tell him not to contact her. And that's the first thing he does is he goes looking for her. Thank goodness she had moved. But this particular case, you know, in June 1999, it was portrayed in an episode of a docudrama series called Obsession Dark Desires, which aired in March 2014. And again, you know, here he is being reported to law enforcement for stalking, for unlawful entry. And he's given a smack on the wrist and told not to do it and not to contact her. So... the chain of events, you know, the escalation all unfolded and he was allowed to commit these predatory and dangerous offenses against women.
And maybe this will lead into, you know, our next episode when we talk about drawing all this together. Like, does law enforcement not know that he's got all these other...
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of these are all in the same area, so I don't think they have that excuse, but... I think we should get into it a little more deeply in our next episode. Okay. And I want to thank the listeners for being so loyal to us and to this series that we're doing on murders in the Bayou, particularly in the area of Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
So we spent a lot of time going through a lot of victims, sadly, here and the victimology. And we do want to honor them and obviously their families. These were brutal and vicious attacks. And their loved ones were taken away from them so violently. And many of these women were in the prime of their life as well. So as always with Real Crime Profile, we want to give a voice to the victims and honor honouring their lives and learning from their deaths. And our thoughts, as always, are with their family and friends who have to live with this.
And once again, if there's anybody out there who is a family member, friend of these victims, always feel that you can reach out to us. You know, we don't have to, you know, read your letter or your comments on the air at all. Or if you just want to express something about somebody that you know who was a victim in all of these crimes, I mean, it hardly seems that there couldn't be somebody out there who's listening right now who knew some of these yeah. victims. And but please reach out to us, and we would love to have a dialogue with you if that's what you'd like.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Till next time.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.